Let's go on to a chapter that's called A Tour of the Cell, because we are going to examine the major constituents of a cell, most of which are organelles, one by one, once we get into the chapter. But first, let's look at where cells are in the range of sizes of things. This is a logarithmic scale, just like pH, so every step is 10 times bigger than the step below it. That means if you go two steps, it's 100 times bigger, three steps, 1,000, and so on. And so there's an enormous range of sizes here, from 0.1 nanometers down at the level of individual atoms, all the way up to 10 meters, like sequoia trees. Cells, though, are in this mid-range, and notice that the cells are in a pretty narrow range, meaning that more or less all cells are pretty much the same size. There are some cells that, there's some range in cell size, of course, like prokaryotic cells are typically smaller than eukaryotic cells, but they're still both pretty small. Now, when you started your life, as we've talked about before, you started as a zygote, right, formed by the fusion of your father's sperm and your mother's egg. And that zygote was a typical size cell, somewhere just below the ability of humans to see with the naked eye. All of this stuff is big enough to see. But cells are almost all cells. There are some exceptions. There are some tremendously big cells that are exceptions that we can see. But mostly we need a light microscope. An electron microscope has much higher magnification and resolution, and it can give us much better detail of what's in a cell, but can also allow us to see things that a light microscope isn't even powerful enough to give to a show. But I'll talk more about this fact that more or less all cells are pretty much the same size in a minute. First, let's look at a representative prokaryotic cell, slide 2. So this could be a bacterium, for instance, a typical prokaryotic cell. Remember, by being a prokaryote, that means it does not have a true nucleus. A true nucleus is one that is a membrane-bounded organelle. It has its own membrane surrounding it. Well, that doesn't occur in a prokaryote. That's the reason for it being named prokaryote. But keep in mind that a prokaryotic cell not only doesn't have a membrane-bounded nucleus, it also doesn't have any other membrane-bounded organelles, which means it has just one membrane, the membrane that all cells have, the membrane for the plasma membrane. You're not a cell if you don't have a plasma membrane. So it has a membrane, but it has just that one, and therefore it has only one compartment inside it. Whereas a eukaryotic cell has sub-compartments made by having other membranes in there forming the membrane-bounded organelles. Well, even though there's no nucleus in a prokaryotic cell, there is, of course, DNA, like I was saying before, for the same reason. It's just part of the one compartment. That one compartment is the cytoplasm. Everything inside the plasma membrane is cytoplasm. And the DNA is part of the cytoplasm, but it's not just randomly dispersed. It's kind of concentrated in one region in the cytoplasm that we call the nucleoid. Be careful with that word, because it means like a nucleus. The oid means like. But it's not a true nucleus. It doesn't have its own membrane. This is kind of a catch-all picture, because not all prokaryotic cells will have every one of these features, but some of them have flagella, which is the plural of flagellum. A flagellum is a kind of a whip-like appendage that when it moves, propels the cell through the liquid medium in which it lives. So it's a locomotory device. These fimbriae are much shorter and kind of look like little hairs, even though they're not hair. Those, if they're present, not they aren't on all cells, but fimbriae allow for attachment to some surface. Like, for instance, to the back of your throat, if you're being infected by it. Nearly all prokaryotes, in addition to the plasma membrane that any cell is going to have, also has a cell wall. which is much thicker than the plasma membrane and much sturdier and is exterior to the plasma membrane itself. Our own cells, as animal cells don't have cell walls, but prokaryotic cells do, and plant cells do, and fungi do. Anyway, that's the thicker yellow layer. And then you also, within the cytoplasm, see a bunch of brown dots, each of which is a ribosome that we mentioned earlier. A ribosome is an organelle. I consider it to be an organelle, at least. But it certainly is not a membrane-bounded organelle. So it's still true that prokaryotic cells don't have any membrane-bounded organelles. They do have ribosomes. They absolutely require ribosomes, just like all cells that have any chance of making a protein do, because that's what ribosomes' job is. It's a little molecular machine for assembling polypeptides, one amino acid at a time, using the instructions in RNA to do so. All right, let's go to 3. Here we are looking at just a tiny region of the overall plasma membrane in a cell. And we've already talked about the fact that a plasma membrane, or actually any membrane, because when I talk about the membrane-bounded organelles that eukaryotic cells have, the membranes of those organelles are really basically the same as plasma membrane, as the same substructure, which is mostly phospholipids arranged in a bilayer. We've already talked about that. And I told you that if you have just phospholipids as molecules and you put them in pure water with no life, they will self-assemble into what looks like a cell, because it'll be a sphere, a bag made out of phospholipid bilayer. But that can't be, or that's not a complete plasma membrane. A cell, which has to be alive, can't have a membrane made of nothing but phospholipids, because phospholipids form a barrier through which certain things can get and other things can't. Well, some of those things that can't easily get through the phospholipid bilayer are things that cells actually have to get through the membrane, in either into the cell or out of the cell. And so there has to be other things besides phospholipids to make up the membrane to, so the cell can keep living and exchanging materials with the surroundings. And there are various things, but important components other than the phospholipids are proteins embedded in the membrane. So these are examples of the phrase membrane bound as opposed to membrane bounded, right? These are membrane bound proteins because they are bound to or part of the membrane, whereas something that's enclosed by its own membrane is membrane bounded. All right, let's go to 4. Now, back to this notion of you starting out as a zygote, a single cell, you are, of course, now much bigger than that. But it never happens that a human grows up to adult size simply by the zygote cell getting adult human-sized. You're not just one enormous cell, in other words. And no organism is, because it's impossible for a living cell to get big in all three dimensions, width, height, and depth. There's a limit to how big cells can get in all three dimensions. Now, certain cells can get big in two of the three dimensions. It might get long, or it might get big and flat, but it's not going to also be thick. One of the three dimensions has to remain small. And that's because there's a constraint put on the size of the cell known as the surface area to volume ratio. Like any ratio, it's just a fraction, one number divided by another, right? But in the case of surface area to volume ratio, it's the surface area value divided by the volume value that is the overall ratio. To make things easier mathematically to think about, we're representing a cell by a perfect cube. No cell is really a perfect cube, but some are cubic. Anyway, it doesn't matter what the units are here. This cube, though, this cell, is one by one by one unit. Okay? Therefore, what is its overall surface area? Well, you can cheat and read it, but think about how you would compute the surface area. The total surface is 6 squares, right? It has 6 sides. Each side is 1 by 1. So the area of a single square is 1 times 1, or 1 square unit. There are 6 of those, so it's 6 overall square units of surface area that it has. The volume, on the other hand, is 3-dimensional. It's 1 by 1 by 1, length times width times height. So 1 times 1 times 1 is 1 cubic unit of volume. And therefore, the surface area to volume ratio is simply 6 divided by 1, which is 6. Now let's grow the cell, and grow it in all 3 dimensions at the same time. It's going to get 5 times as high, 5 times as deep, 5 times as wide to make this big cell that you see in the middle. The point here is that when a cell grows in all 3 dimensions, the surface area is going to get bigger, obviously. Well, the volume is going to get bigger, obviously, as well, right? But the volume is going to get bigger quicker than the surface area does. Mathematically, that's illustrated here by this graph I was drawing. Y equals x squared, which is surface area, right, is this curve. Y equals x cubed, which is volume, gets bigger a lot faster. Therefore, when a cell grows, the volume outgrows the surface area. Now let's look at the values here. When you make it 5 times as big in all 3 dimensions, each face is 5 by 5, which is 25 square units, times 6 is 150. Obviously, it went up from 6. But the volume is now 5 times 5 times 5, which is 125. It got fast bigger than the surface area did. It's 125 times the volume that it started with. It's not the case for surface area, right? So the reason this is important biologically is that for a cell to remain alive, it has to continuously exchange materials with its surroundings. It has to bring things in, it has to get rid of things. And the only way, the only place on a cell that you can exchange things with the surroundings is at the boundary between you and the surroundings, which is the surface. All right? Well, if you make a volume that's really big, then you're going to have a hell of a lot of materials that you need to exchange. And since volume outgrows or gets big faster than surface area, you're eventually going to have a cell that is so big in volume that you won't have enough surface for it to exchange the correct materials, the correct amount of materials. And that's why you don't have enormous cells in all 3 dimensions. We are huge as an organism individually, but that's because we're multicellular. So we get big not by one cell growing into a huge size, but by cells splitting into new cells. And our body, which is represented by this cube, is the same volume as this 5 by 5 by 5 cube, but it's made out of a bunch of 1 by 1 by 1 cubes, little cells, each of which have a surface area to volume ratio much higher. Notice that when you grew the cell to 5, the surface area to volume ratio went down because volume got too big too fast. Multicellularity solves that problem, though. Each individual cell still has enough surface area to service its volume. All right, now to 5. This is another catch-all slide, meaning that any individual animal cell isn't necessarily going to feature every one of these things we're going to talk about. It's just all grouped into one. It's not labeled as an animal cell, but what's a good clue that this is an animal cell? Well, the nucleus is a good indication that it's a eukaryotic cell, but animals are just one kind of eukaryote. Plants, for instance, are eukaryotic, and they'll have a nucleus as well. So are fungi. So are protists. What I was getting at is that this cell, of course, like any cell, has a plasma membrane, but there's no cell wall. It's just a plasma membrane, like our own cells. We are animals. Okay, so let's go through these as much as I can before we run out of time. The most conspicuous one here is the big purple nucleus. Of course, nuclei are not really purple. These are just made up colors. And I wish they'd kind of use other colors, because depending on where you're sitting, you might not see a difference between the purple and the blue here, but those are separate organelles. The nucleus is an organelle, and it is more specifically a membrane-bounded organelle because it's enclosed by its own membrane. And even more specifically, it is the first of three examples that I'll give you as we go through these of an organelle that is multiply membrane-bounded, because there are two membranes covering the nucleus, not just one. And keep in mind, when I say one membrane, that's already two layers of phospholipids. It's one bilayer, which is really two layers, makes up one membrane. But the nucleus has two of those bilayers. You can kind of see it here in the cutaway view, depending on how close you are. So there's an outer nuclear membrane and an inner nuclear membrane. And together, they form what is called the nuclear envelope. That's both membranes together, forming the boundary of the nucleus with the rest of the cell. And that's its own compartment. Like I said, the eukaryotic cells are compartmentalized because of these membrane-bounded organelles they have. They have a cytoplasm, like a prokaryotic cell does, but it's not everything that's inside the plasma membrane. Instead, in a eukaryotic cell, the cytoplasm is everything that's inside the plasma membrane, but also outside of the membrane-bounded organelles. So all the spaces between here that aren't in any organelle, that's all cytoplasm. By the way, the stuff inside the nucleus gets its own name, which is nucleoplasm, literally nucleus stuff. And you can see by the bracket that the contents of the nucleus includes chromatin. Well, chromatin is a mixture of DNA and proteins. And we'll talk more about it in a different chapter, but we call it chromatin when it's just loosely strewn throughout the nucleus. Later on in the lifetime of this individual cell, namely when it gets ready to split into two, the chromatin will clump together tightly and form what look like individual strands. It's the same stuff, but we then call it chromosomes. It's made out of chromatin, though. Be careful with the word nucleolus, which is separate from nucleus. Nucleolus is part of the nucleus. It's this dark region in the cartoon here. And the nucleolus is a place in the nucleus where other kinds of RNA, besides messenger RNA, are produced. Also, on the surface of the nuclear envelope, you can maybe make it out from where you are, there are complexes of proteins here and there, arranged into shapes that make them like little tunnels or pores. So there are pores in the nuclear envelope, and those are important for what I was talking about before. Transcription has to happen where the DNA is. In a eukaryotic cell, which this is, the DNA is in the nucleus. So that's where the messenger RNA gets produced. But translation, involving the ribosome to assemble the polypeptide, occurs out in the cytoplasm. So the mRNA has to get out of the nucleus in order for that to happen. There have to be passageways for that to happen. Those are the nuclear pores. One of the main reasons I was saying earlier that it would be nice if they used more drastically different colors is that you can see at different places, namely here, for one, the outer membrane of the nucleus folds outward and changes color from purple to blue in the book to become part of this next overall organelle. It's all continuous membrane-wise, but they're considered to be distinct organelles. All of this blue stuff, including these flattened sacs and these tubes, together make up one complex organelle called the endoplasmic reticulum, ER for short. But the overall organelle, which is the whole endoplasmic reticulum, is made up of the rough ER and the smooth ER. Now, the rough ER is the part that looks like flattened sacs. And this is a cutaway view, so they've been cut in half. What makes it, why they call it rough ER, is that the surface of these flattened sacs feature a bunch of these brown dots, which are the ribosomes we talked about. Okay, so the ribosomes are their own organelles, but these ribosomes happen to be attached to the surface of the rough ER, and that's what makes that surface look rough microscopically. The smooth ER doesn't have the ribosomes attached, so that's what makes it smooth looking, but it's also more tubular than like flattened sacs. It's all one system of membrane, though, forming both of those parts. The two parts not only look different, they function differently, though, as you'd probably expect. The job of the rough endoplasmic reticulum is to modify newly made polypeptides. So when polypeptides are manufactured one amino acid at a time by ribosomes, some of those polypeptides, before they can do their job, need to be modified. And that's the job of the rough ER, which explains why there's ribosomes attached. Those ribosomes are busy stringing, like assembly lines, longer and longer polypeptides into the hollow interior of the rough ER. By the way, the hollow interior is the lumen. Any structure that's hollow has a lumen. The food that you put in your stomach is in the lumen of the stomach. Okay, so that explains why there are ribosomes associated with the rough ER. The smooth ER isn't about modification of proteins. It has various functions, including storing calcium ions, but it's also a site for lipid synthesis. Lipids get manufactured in the smooth ER. And I don't have time to go into all of the Golgi apparatus, but remind me I'm on the Golgi next time. I just don't want you to think that because it's so similarly shaped that this is the same organelle. If it weren't for the color coding, you probably would mistake this for endoplasmic reticulum, but the Golgi apparatus is its own membrane-bounded organelle that we'll talk about next time.